Hi, this is Lori with the Vermont Department of Health, and we're going to get started on our presentation today. So the presentation's on mold, and we are fortunate to have Dr. Sumner, who is the state epidemiologist for environmental health. He is a board-certified physician in internal medicine and in environmental and occupational medicine, and Dr. Sumner also holds a master's degree in public health. Following his presentation, we'll have a 10-minute question and answer session, so please hold your questions until the end. Thanks.
Excellent. Well, good afternoon. We will go ahead and get started. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. So just a little bit of background. I've been working on mold issues. My first experience with mold was back in 98 when I was working with the CDC, and the CDC was in the process of retracting their case series involving pediatric hemosiderosis. So I've been very involved in mold from both a clinical perspective as well as a public health perspective for over 10 years now. So my I'm going to keep the presentation ideally focused and moving forward. And today's presentation on slide two, we will be just having an introduction to mold, role of town health officers as it relates to mold, building compliance, and then we will end with health effects related to mold. So on slide three, what is mold? Mold or mildew are a common name given to filamentous fungus. That's usually sort of a fungus that's sort of hairy in nature. There are thousands of species of fungus that are frequently lumped into the term mold. These fungi can be of a variety of type, color, and texture. And in many cases, for our purposes, the mere presence of mold is the issue as opposed to a specific species or genus of mold. It's important to realize that mold will grow anywhere that there is moisture and a food source. A food source is any carbon source of carbon. Molds and fungi act as decomposers in the natural environment. That role as a decomposer is very important because it allows nutrients to be recycled. However, in houses and on man-made structures, this decomposition is not appreciated. But the two important pieces for mold growth to occur is that there be moisture and a food source. After a surface becomes moist, mold can grow in as little as 24 to 48 hours. Most modern building materials are ample sources of food for mold. This includes sheetrock, wallpaper, insulation. All of these things that contain carbon can be a growth medium for mold. Now, on slide number four, approach to handling mold calls. At the health department, we frequently get calls about mold, and I imagine most of you frequently get calls about mold. They tend to be challenging and frustrating calls, but I hope to lay out an approach that will help in addressing mold-related calls that you get. So first of all, it is very important to separate the building from the individual complaining, the mold source from the individual that is claiming to be sick. I would strongly advise, if someone is reporting health symptoms to you that they claim to be related to mold, that you direct them to their medical provider and that you don't provide specific information about the health effects of mold. It is an area where there is controversy, and it is an area that it would, to save challenges, it is best not to necessarily get involved in. However, what I do want you to consider is the mold in a building. If there is mold in a building, it should not be there, and keeping the discussion squarely in the realm of the presence of mold in a building versus the absence of mold is a strategy that I would recommend. Personal injury And the diagnosis of medical illness really do require the oversight of the medical provider for the individual in question. Also, mold in recent past has been heavily litigated. When mold situations are inadequately remediated or when people feel that they've been made sick, you want to avoid that litigation process. So the advice that the health department, on slide number 5, the advice that the health department gives is at this time we do not recommend air sampling for mold. The reason we do not recommend air sampling for mold is air sampling is highly variable. There are no standards to compare to, and the results are challenging to interpret. What we do recommend, though, is a thorough visual inspection. If you see mold, there is a problem with mold, and that steps should be taken to correct the problem, and that air sampling is not necessary to validate that there is indeed a problem, and it is not necessarily necessary to determine the exact species of mold growing in an indoor environment. Next slide. Mold in the living space. Mold growth is an indication that water is present and that there is a building maintenance issue. That does not necessarily mean that the mold, if people are reporting health effects, then mold is the cause of the health effects. And that is why I advise not getting directly involved in health effects related to mold. However, if mold is present, as I said, it indicates the presence of a water source or water intrusion. That source of water needs to be identified and eliminated, and then the water damage either needs to be rapidly dried or the water damage material should be removed. When I refer to rapid drying, I would recommend drying be completed within a 72-hour period due to the fact that mold can grow very quickly. Next slide, on slide 7, is the role of the town health officer. Generally, as it is laid out in statute, the role of the health officer is to conduct an investigation after receiving information regarding a condition that may be a public health hazard, followed by enforcement of the provisions of Title 18, followed by the prevention prevent, remove, or destroy any public health hazard or mitigate any significant public health risk in accordance with Title 18. So that's what the statutes say, but I want to try and give some more helpful information. When you've received a complaint of mold and you are going to conduct an investigation, there's a few things that I would recommend. One is that you bring a camera so that you can document the presence of mold. Number two, the most useful tool is to bring a flashlight so that you can see appropriately in poorly lit areas, and that you do and then you conduct and you bring the inspection questionnaire. Inspection questionnaire can be found in the back of the manual, although we are currently working on updating that. So during the visual inspection, or during the inspection, what is important is to try and look at all sources where there could be moisture, or to visually find sources where there could be mold. That really just means looking in all rooms on all surfaces. Another very helpful tool is if you smell mustiness or dampness, then there is likely to be a water intrusion process. Areas to specifically look for mold would be basements and attics, flooded areas, bathrooms, kitchens, and closets, particularly bathrooms that aren't ventilated, around where food is stored, around the refrigerator, around mattresses and other furniture, windowsills, areas that are caulked, as well as carpeting. So recommendations can be made to mitigate small areas of mold. And when I say small, I really mean isolated patch that is inches in diameter. These can really be cleaned if they're on a hard surface with a variety of detergents. The most common recommendation is using a bleach solution, which should be a 1-to-10 ratio. It's important to remember that we never mix bleach and ammonia, as that will cause toxic gas formation. Now, it is not my expectation that a town health officer would do this, that they would provide this service of doing the cleaning, but more they can instruct a member of the public that small areas can be cleaned in this way. Now, I wanted to move on specifically to mold and rental housing. This is an area where you will frequently, or I suspect most frequently, get your calls. If there is visible mold growth in a rental property, this indicates that there is excessive moisture and or standing water. Excessive moisture and periodic or regular standing water is a violation of the Rental Housing Health Code, Section 8C. The landlord should be informed in writing that the rental housing code, that there is a rental housing code violation, and that you should request that they voluntarily comply and address the problem. I would then encourage a 30-day follow-up to see whether the situation has been adequately resolved. A helpful strategy, though, when conducting a rental housing inspection where you've received a complaint of mold, is to ask the landlord or the landlord's representative to accompany you on that inspection so that they can see the mold themselves at the same time that you are seeing it. So on slide 12, the section 8C is written out, and 8C specifically says, every dwelling unit, rooming house, or rooming unit shall be maintained to be free from regular or periodic appearance of standing water or excessive moisture, which may result in visible mold growth. I think it's helpful to try and elicit voluntary compliance first, and only after a reasonable period of time and voluntary compliance has not been achieved would I encourage you to consider taking next steps. Now, it's also very important that you not provide specific advice as to how the landlord mitigate the problem, more just say that they need to come into compliance. Strategies for mitigating the problem would include identifying source of moisture intrusion, and then eliminating source of moisture intrusion, and then removing water damaged building materials. These are general, broad guidelines. You do not need to specifically tell a landlord how to resolve the problem, except that they do need to resolve the problem. The landlord can certainly be directed to guidelines that are put out from the EPA. For large buildings, I would certainly advise that they hire a contractor that's knowledgeable about mold remediation. It is important to remember that there is no licensing or certification requirements for mold abatement contractors, nor are there cleanup levels or specifications or guidance levels as to how clean is clean and when mold is when the problem has been adequately addressed. The main point is if there is presence of mold in a rental property, this is a violation of the Rental Housing Code, and we just want them to come into compliance with the Rental Housing Code. A few strategies to prevent mold growth are appropriate ventilation, particularly in bathrooms, store perishables in refrigerators or Ziploc bags, don't carpet damp area, the use of dehumidifiers, clean damp areas often so that they can be allowed to dry. And then there are some building products in particular that are resistant to mold growth. But the main thing is to prevent leaks or to address them rapidly. So now I'm going to shift a little bit to the potential health effects associated with mold. And this is more for your general information, so that when people ask you, you have some understanding. However, I would strongly advise not providing people health recommendations or guidance as it relates to mold. I would defer them to their healthcare providers. So there are many myths about mold. If you look on the internet, you can find all sorts of references to toxic mold and a wide variety of health effects that people have experienced. The evidence suggests that some people do have problems with mold. The most frequently reported, or the most common, is that individuals have some general irritation of the nose, eyes, and mucosal membranes associated with large mold infestations. Additionally, the people that are at greatest risk are those that suffer from allergy or asthma related to mold. Mold can subsequently trigger that allergy or be a trigger for asthma, and that can really compromise someone's control of their allergies and asthma. A more serious condition that is described in the medical literature is something that's called hypersensitivity pneumonitis. This is a disease of small non-caseating granulomas forming in the lungs, frequently associated with cough, fever, breathlessness. This is something that should certainly be referred to a medical provider. The hypersensitivity pneumonitis does occur infrequently and has best been described as mold as it relates to silos, where farmers have walked into a large silo with moldy grain, they've disturbed the grain, and they've had a large exposure to spores of a particular type of mold. This is not a common disease outcome and would result in fever, shortness of breath, possibly infiltrates on their x-ray. And then lastly, in an immunocompromised population, such as a severe diabetic, someone suffering from HIV, or having organ transplant, there is the possibility of a fungal infection where the fungus is actually growing in their lungs or in their sinuses. Again, this is very uncommon. It's associated with a very small, specific population that is immunocompromised. So my last slide here is the outcomes with mold are associated with the length of exposure, the amount, and someone having underlying disease problems. Mold is found everywhere, and some people are more susceptible, but the general population does not react to mold. I would advise staying away from words in your write-ups of severe public health hazard, or really referring to the medical issues related to mold. More, I would just advise that people follow up with their medical providers, and that during your inspection you identify visual evidence of mold and you recommend that that moisture problem be resolved. On the last slide, there are some resources, and I would now like to open it up to any questions.
Hi, Austin. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
This is Sharon McDonald in Peacham.
Hi, Sharon.
Excellent presentation, as usual. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to make sure. So basically, what I think you've tried to say very clearly is that if a person is concerned about mold, the idea is that mold is bad because living in wet conditions is bad, and that we are going to address that. And if they feel like there are health conditions associated with it, that they would need to check with their physician.
That is exactly correct.
Now, if you can smell mold, but it's something like maybe been a roof leak or something like that, and you can't see anything specifically, then they are advised to have that investigated with a contractor and hopefully somebody that does get it but won't take all their money?
Yes. that having someone in, if you are suspicious that there is a water intrusion issue due to a musty smell, but after thorough visual inspection, you cannot identify a source of water intrusion or the source of the smell, I would certainly encourage that they have the landlord retain the services of someone that can do a slightly further investigation. Additional investigation techniques can include moisture meters, infrared photography of problem areas, because that will moist or damp building materials conduct heat differently than the non-damp materials. And then there's also the possibility of invasive steps where parts of wallboards are removed to understand if there's moisture behind them. This is not something that I would see in the scope of a town health officer, and I would suggest that you advise landlords to take those steps, although if you don't have any compelling evidence, it makes it hard to really require those steps.
Lastly, the form for the home assessment,
yes.
I don't have that here. I know it's only in a working, you said it was being updated.
Yes.
Something, I assume that it's not just for mold, but for other kinds of problems?
I'm sorry. So there is more than one questionnaire in the back of the manual. In the manual, there is a rental housing complaint form, which is the one that we're updating that will address mold and other sources of bioaerosols a little more clearly, ideally. Then there's a more general just complaint form, which doesn't have that much information, but it would be a means of tracking your complaint form. I mean,
I think my manual was put out the year that they established town health officers.
You don't have an updated manual?
No. Are some of these forms on the internet?
Well, the updated manual is on the internet, and that they are in the. If you look at the, if you go to the town health officer website. And you look at the table of contents for the town health officer manual. It is a forms. It's just called forms, I believe, and it's the very last few pages of the manual.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry to take too many questions, but I hope somebody else has something.
Hello, this is Peter King from Fairfax.
Hello, Peter.
How are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
Excellent presentation. The question I have is the problem we've had here in the town is a lot of our landlords don't live in Vermont, so we do everything for correspondence to the mail. We have had not much success with anybody meeting our requests. Being a new health officer, the question always comes to mind, what is the next step and what is the process? What, is there a form letter that has to be drafted by a lawyer? When you're going to go a Title 18 violation or referring to a Title 18 violation, what happens there? I don't know if anybody
so,
that.
So, as I said, we want to achieve voluntary compliance. If voluntary compliance is not working, the next step would be to write a regular health order. To write a regular health order, there are a few steps involved. First of all, you need to write the order, you need to have supporting documentation, you would want consultation from your town attorney, and then the regular health order would have to be approved by the local health board, which is the select board and the town health officer together. Ideally would then, the owner would have to be served the health order. If the landlord chose not to follow the health order at that time, the town attorney could enter the health order into court, requesting injunctive relief. The tenant, though, also the tenant should be encouraged to take advantage of their rights under the warranty of habitability, though, as well. Once you've documented that there is a non-compliance, the tenant should certainly obtain legal advice from their own legal counsel, but they can take additional steps once a violation of the rental housing code has been documented, a reasonable period of time has been given for the landlord to correct it, and no action has been taken. Tenants can then utilize their rights under the warranty of habitability and decide whether withholding rent is appropriate or what have you.
Okay.
And so tenants should certainly be encouraged to follow through on their rights. And ideally, you will, when you send the letter in writing to the landlord, you will CC the tenant so that both parties are aware of the actions that are forthcoming. The reason I recommend having a landlord or the landlord representative present is that they can just see at the same time that see the same things that you're seeing, so that it's just very clear where the problems exist.
Okay. I didn't know if this, when it's the letter that was sent to a landlord, it sounds like it's drafted by your town attorney or city attorney.
If the initial response has not taken any action, I don't know that the town attorney needs to draft the letter, but should certainly be made aware of the situation.
You draft, but they have to approve it.
I'm not a lawyer, so I wouldn't even know how to draft a letter. Does the Vermont Health Department have any kind of a letter or something in a form that we can work out of?
So I'm just a little clarity from you. So you're saying when a health order is being issued, or just the routine letter that you're sending about non-compliance?
Well, the non-compliance is not the problem. It's when they do not comply within 30 days, you need to take the next step. And that's the letter I'm questioning. That becomes a little bit more critical, I think, on wording and how it's applied. And like I said, not being a litigator, I wouldn't know where to begin writing something like that.
Well, it's really the health order that you're now moving towards. There was recently some guidance that was circulated from fellow health officers. We have not developed any updated outside of what's in the manual. We do not have an updated draft for what a health order should look like. That is certainly on our to-do list, but we haven't gotten there yet. But there was on the town health officer from South Burlington had been kind enough to circulate some examples of what he has used, and we can certainly recirculate those documents as for some help. And now you're on the listserv, is that correct, Peter?
Yes, I am, but for some reason I did not get it. I heard it was out there. Who's the health officer from South Burlington? I'll make contact with him.
Chuck Hafter.
Okay, I know the gentleman.
Would you like us to recirculate the email?
Yeah, it would be nice if you could.
I think I saved it. But Marielle saved it. Okay, so we will recirculate those model orders. It is on our list of activities to update that material. We haven't yet.
You mentioned that the mold form was on the manual at the end.
No, it's there is a housing inspection form. It's not specific to mold. The main steps when conducting a mold investigation is to try and look at all surfaces, take a flashlight with you. Would certainly would recommend not wearing nice clothes or wearing wearing some clothes that you can get down on your knees and really have a good look around.
Very good. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Additional questions?
I have one more. I think that this, for the housing inspection, we have a house that's being sold that is not in compliance in a variety of things, and it's almost like the health order, should we append it to the deed, or we're trying to figure out what we can do to make sure that various people are informed, or that the condition of the house is known?
Well, there is buyer due diligence. And I would just caution about the level of involvement. If it's not something that specifically falls under Title 18, then the health officer is potentially, I mean, I'm speaking more generally, not necessarily just to your situation, that if it's not under Title 18, then being very involved in it as the health officer. Now, I mean, the select board, what have you, can make decisions, but I don't know that you need to lead the fight to put that in there. So just a little more background, is it going to remain a rental property?
It's not a rental property. It's a lead and sewage problem.
I see.
But the transfer to another owner, in this case, and I'm actually that situation has worked out, but what we were unclear of is kind of the steps to take.
Okay.
Because it's not private, because it's private property, that sort of opts us out from responsibility in theory?
It does. I mean, unless you're concerned of in terms of septic, I mean, if it's a failed septic, I would inform Department of Environmental Conservation, their enforcement division. And outside of that, I would not, on a private issue, would not be involved unless there's really pooling septic material in the yard, in which case I would say to temporarily mitigate the most serious public health problem, you can advocate for fencing off the area and putting straw and lime down. But to some degree, if a private property is not violating specific regs, they are entitled to do on their property, or they have all the privileges of home ownership then.
Okay. Do you think at another time, I have a lead question I want to ask about. Who should I call?
Well, you can specifically, if it's, you can call our CLIP program, our Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention Program. Is it related to, what's it related to?
It's related to two kids that were living in a home. They've been toxic lead. They're moving out.
Okay.
And the question is, of the stuff that they're moving out of the house, it might be nice to get dust out of it. And the question was, if you took like mattresses and couches and things like that and took them out and, you know, had people kind of protected and beat the crap out of them, would that be sufficient, or should they not be even moving mattresses and things like that?
In terms of a lead dust risk, I would say that wet wiping and HEPA vacuuming is certainly a superior strategy than flailing.
Okay. Flailers or HEPA vacuers be wearing masks?
I would certainly recommend it just from a nuisance dust level. Essentially, you don't know whether the surfaces are contaminated with lead. You just know it's an old house and there's flaking paint, right?
We know it's, yeah. I mean, it's just the kids are toxic. One of them's over 20 quite a bit. It's not been coming down. The rooms have all been tested by BDH. Or whoever.
Okay, our case manager has come out and seen this situation. And the primary family is moving out, so the concern is how to best handle their furniture if they're moving it out. I would certainly say having it cleaned, wet wiped, or HEPA vacuumed would be the strategy. I would certainly recommend good hygiene. If it's being done by the individuals themselves, I would certainly recommend good hygiene practices, which in my mind would include wearing an N95 dust mask for comfort purposes, for nuisance dust, and then changing their clothes or washing their clothes after they've done it separately so it doesn't contaminate other clothes, and washing their hands before they eat or smoke or do any activities along those lines.
Fine.
Okay, so I think we are at 1 o'clock now. I don't want to take up anybody's any more time. However, if there are additional questions in the environmental health nature, our 800 number is 800-439-8550, and you can be directed to any one of the environmental health sections, and they can try and help with specific questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Okay, bye-bye.